This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Bill Easterly, professor of economics at New York University and co-director of NYU's Development Research Institute. His previous books include The White Man's Burden and The Elusive Quest for Growth, and he has published columns and reviews for The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, New York Review of Books, and Washington Post. Bill Easterly is here today to tell us about his most recent book, The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor, published in 2014. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Diane.
What led you to write your book, The Tyranny of Experts?
Really, it was coming out of a lot of frustration that the basic, the most elementary human rights of the poor were being violated with impunity by autocratic governments and aid agencies, and nobody seemed to care. I started the book with an example from Uganda, where some peasants in Uganda, in the course of a World Bank project, had their lands taken from them at gunpoint, and they were marched away from their own lands. Their homes were burnt down, their crops torched, their dairy cows killed with machine guns. And this actually did make it onto the front page of the New York Times. But then what happened after that was there were sort of two non-events that really infuriated me. The first was that the World Bank promised to investigate its own role in this tragedy so that it would never happen again. Well, it never did that and has never done an investigation. The second non-event was that nobody seemed to be paying attention. Nobody seemed to care that the World Bank failed to investigate its own role. And so now, 4 years later, it's almost exactly 4 years ago that this happened. Everybody has forgotten this incident. So that's what I mean when I say the forgotten rights of the poor. We don't seem to care about the rights of poor people.
Would you expand on what you think is wrong with our current approach to development?
Well, the current approach to development is one that focuses very much on technical solutions. And we don't really say who is going to be doing these technical solutions. We say, you know, the solution to malaria is bed nets, the solution to, or say, spraying the residences inside with a chemical named pyrethrum to prevent mosquitoes from being inside homes. So we think of these as, you know, direct technical fixes to malaria. What we don't take into account is who is going to be doing these fixes and why haven't they done them already? The answer in both instances is we're working with the local government, which is often a dictator who doesn't really care about fixing the problems of the poor. The dictator just cares about keeping his own power.
What do you consider to be the underlying cause of global poverty?
Well, that's the other big thing, is that the dictator himself and his predecessors, the autocracy as a system, is itself the cause of poverty. You know, when we work with autocrats, it's like one of these sort of crime stories in which you're working with a police captain that you think is going to be the good guy helping you solve someone's problem, and then there's a surprise twist that he turns out to be the bad guy, and he's actually working behind your back to hurt the person you're trying to help. That's sort of what's going on with dictators. We're working with them as if they're the solution, but really they're the problem. They're themselves the cause of poverty by suppressing poor people's rights, poor people's ability to speak up and protest and demand solutions.
Well, the title of your book is The Tyranny of Experts. What do you see as the problem with using expertise in development?
Of course, expertise is part of the solution in development, spreading technical knowledge on how to fix problems. The problem with experts that operate in development is, again, their silence on rights of the poor, their willingness to work with the autocrats to turn everything over to the autocrats, and their failure to protest when autocrats are violating these rights. So somebody like Bill Gates, whom I respect very much for his work on poverty, but he winds up praising the government of Ethiopia as achieving great reductions in child mortality and reduction in poverty. And the evidence is that the dictator did not reduce that. That fell for other reasons, mothers on their own finding better medicines for their own children. The evidence is that democracies are much better than dictators at reducing child mortality and ending poverty. So, you know, I think we're just working with the wrong set of ideas in fighting poverty when we privilege dictators and we praise dictators and we don't respect the dissidents who are in jail in Ethiopia fighting against this dictator.
Would you compare what you call free development to authoritarian development?
Yeah, so the great thing about when you do respect rights of the poor, you set up this enormous society-wide problem-solving system. So when people have the rights to protest, whenever there's a problem, we hear about it. And there's consequences from those protests because people have the power to vote bad governments out of office. You know, a sign that our own democracy works well is that even something comparatively trivial as a traffic jam on a bridge caused enormous political consequences for New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. And yet, you know, the counterpart to that was something much worse in Uganda had no consequences for the World Bank or for the dictator of Uganda. So free development is this ability to have the sort of squeaky wheel get the grease, whereas the autocrat, the authoritarian development effectively sentences the squeaky wheel to a long prison term.
Who or what groups have been in favor of the authoritarian approach to development?
Well, nobody holds up a sign saying we love autocrats, we want to violate rights of poor people. This is all, it's really a matter of silence rather than outright support of autocrats. Although there are occasions, as the example I just gave of Gates praising the Ethiopian dictator, there are many examples of aid agencies praising dictators. But it's really the whole kind of official development establishment, aid establishment, which consists of the official aid agencies like the World Bank, the U.S. government aid agency, USAID, and private philanthropies like the Gates Foundation. They all seem to embrace this technical, autocratic approach to development, which I'm calling authoritarian development.
And what is the reason for this, in your view?
Well, you know, it is very tempting to believe that technical solutions are a big shortcut to the answer and just kind of assume away the problem of bad government by assuming the autocrat is actually benevolent. One thing that does for us all is it puts us experts as the heroes of the story. And there's something very seductive that's hard to resist about that, that we really want to have the ability to fix the problem. And, you know, I'm talking about very well-intentioned people. I was one of them myself. I'm a recovering expert. You know, well-intentioned experts, they like a story in which we experts have the power at one stroke to implement technical solutions just by handing them over to an all-powerful, benevolent autocrat.
And who are the people or groups that have spoken out against authoritarian development?
Oh, there aren't that many. I mean, the problem really is, it's not that we're losing the debate of authoritarian versus free development. It's really that there has not been a debate at all. There's just a silence. And there are a few groups that have spoken up, like Human Rights Watch and Oxfam. Oxfam publicized the Uganda story that I told you about. Human Rights Watch has publicized human rights violations by Ethiopia's dictator that Bill Gates was praising. So those are the good guys, in my view.
What is the case for the success of free versus authoritarian development? What is the evidence?
You know, there, what we really need to do is use all of the evidence. One strange thing that happened when we discuss evidence is that we leave out the countries that are now rich as possible models for development, which is a pretty strange assumption. When you're looking for models how to succeed at development, you leave out all the cases that have actually succeeded at development. And so, you know, if we do include Japan, North America, Western Europe in the evidence base, those are societies that succeeded through free development, through the growth of democratic and economic rights of the population. And then there are many more that are now coming along, like, you know, Botswana, Taiwan, South Korea, Chile, that are following the path of free development. And, you know, worldwide, the hopeful thing is freedom is spreading around the world. The trends are positive. So this is not a gloomy story. This is a story being on the right side of history.
How does the case of China fit into this picture?
Yeah, that's probably the most common question I get asked about this debate. What we have to remember about China is the reason we're excited about China is that it had a very rapid economic growth rate. It's not that its level of development is high. It's actually still very poor compared to the U.S., but because of the very rapid growth rate, we get excited. You know, there's very rapid progress. Well, you know, the right way to think about a growth rate is if the level of democracy predicts the level of prosperity, then a change in freedom will predict a change in prosperity, which we call economic growth. And I think what's happened in China is there's been actually a lot more freedom than there was under Mao, certainly much more economic freedom. Peasants can do their own family farms rather than work on collective farms. And also even some positive change in political freedom. So even though China is a long way away from freedom, they've had a positive change in freedom, and that's what explains their rapid growth.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Bill Easterly, professor of economics at New York University and author of the book, The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM, and on the web at kexp.org. Well, you alluded to this a bit earlier, but how has the current approach to development hurt human rights?
The biggest thing going on is really it's a sin of omission rather than a sin of commission. That here we're talking about every aspect of poor people's lives, but we're obsessed with their material standard of living and neglecting their rights. And that atmosphere is one in which dictators flourish, in this atmosphere of silence on rights violations. We're also really providing a very good technical justification for a dictator. The dictator is the one that follows us wise experts' advice and does all the technical solutions like spraying the pyrethrum inside the residences and giving bed nets out to prevent malaria. So that it's like we've replaced what used to be the divine right of kings with the development right of dictators.
What events historically have reinforced this material development approach rather than looking more at the rights of individuals in poor countries?
Well, what I woke up to in doing the research of this book is these ideas have roots that are much earlier than what I had realized. So it actually started right after World War I. Woodrow Wilson gave one of the first statements of the idea of material development ignoring rights when he handed over former German colonies to the British Empire and said, "Hey, you guys, the reason you guys deserve to have these colonies is you're so great at raising the material standard of living of your colonial subjects," which was actually false, but that was the justification for giving the British Empire more colonies. And it became an excellent justification for colonial rule throughout the life of the British Empire. That's really the roots of these ideas. They originated at a time when we were so racist, we couldn't even imagine that the rest of the world should deserve equal rights.
How has racism played a role in development?
Well, you know, I'm not going to accuse anyone today of being a racist explicitly. I think, you know, of course, racism is very subtle. It's very unconscious. There's still a lot of it around. Maybe better words that are more on target to use would be condescension and paternalism. There's this mentality that the poor are these sort of passive, helpless beings. We often picture them on the brochures of our charities and aid agencies. Documents as, you know, women and children looking really miserable, really sick, really degraded, and they're just waiting for us sort of white saviors to sweep in and save them. That, I think, is the sort of paternalism and condescension which is so insulting to the dignity of poor people. That itself is a violation of the rights of poor people.
Could you give some additional examples of political rights being ignored in the case of authoritarian development?
Yeah, well, Ethiopia is a kind of natural case because there's been this very long history of kind of the embrace of an Ethiopian dictator named Meles Zenawi, who was in power since 1991 and then died of natural causes in 2012. And during his entire rule, he was kind of lavished with praise by the aid agencies. And yet, he was a serial human rights abuser. There were rigged elections in 2005. He shot down and killed peaceful demonstrators in the streets afterwards. He most recently, before his death, imprisoned a peaceful Ethiopian blogger who was just reporting on the Arab Democratic Spring with a sentence of 18 years in jail, separated from his wife and kids in a miserable, miserable jail. This is a guy named Eskinder Nega that no one has ever heard of. Everyone's heard of Bill Gates. Everyone's heard of Bono and Jeffrey Sachs. But no one's heard of Eskinder Nega, the victim of our neglect of rights.
What have been some of the issues in focusing on development at the level of nation states rather than at the level of individuals? How much do nations, per se, matter as a focus of development?
Yeah, I think part of the reason that we embrace autocrats is we also obsess about nations as being the things that we're developing. It's almost as if we care more about developing the area of land known as Ethiopia than we do care about Ethiopians. And that means we neglect a lot of the things that are going on, and the positive things that are going on are really happening across national borders. So I mentioned earlier that there had been a reduction in child mortality in Ethiopia, and that's really the result of a regional spread throughout Africa of health knowledge and life-saving technology. It's things as simple as soap. Mothers teaching their children to wash their hands after they go to the bathroom, that has an enormous impact on health. The spread of antibiotics, another thing that's just spreading in a very decentralized way with nobody in charge. These are things that are happening across national borders, and yet we're obsessed with what's happening on the nation states, and then we exaggerate the role of the dictators.
Would you speak about the role migration has played and can play in development?
Migration is kind of like the canary in the coal mine that shows how little we respect the rights of poor people. You know, that we have this very hostile attitude towards any skilled African person emigrating from Africa to the rest of the world. And as if they're some kind of traitor to their home nation. You know, and there's really a double standard here because no one gave me grief when I migrated from my birthplace of West Virginia to work now in New York. Nobody calls me a traitor to West Virginia, even though it's a very poor region that needs all the skills it can get. So we really have a double standard, and we're also neglecting that actually these migrations have quite positive impacts. Skilled professionals who migrate abroad, they often return home and bring with them lots of beneficial investments and knowledge.
Would you say more about how migration has a positive effect on those left behind?
Well, of course, most obviously, the migrants are sending lots of money back home. So first of all, the migrants themselves are escaping poverty by migrating, and then they're helping those back home escape poverty. So there's a statistic calculated by a couple of economists that 82% of the Haitians that have ever escaped poverty have done so by moving to the U.S. And now those 82% are helping Haitians back in Haiti escape poverty by sending money back to Haiti. Now, that's not the complete comprehensive answer to development back in Haiti, but it's certainly beneficial. And the fact that we're so hostile to migration just shows how little respect we have for the rights of poor people to live wherever they want, just like we have the right to live wherever we want.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Bill Easterly, professor of economics at New York University and author of the book, The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor. To what extent has history been ignored in designing strategies for development?
Well, you know, I think the origin of development is usually placed sometime after the end of colonialism, and it was sort of this brand new problem that we would suddenly had this new problem of getting poor countries, making them into prosperous ones. Of course, the reality was it was not a brand new problem. The now rich countries themselves used to be very poor countries. The U.S. at the time of the Declaration of Independence was much poorer than any African country today. And yet it chose the path of free development. And of course, the ideal that all men are created equal is not respected right away in the U.S. It's taken many generations and it's still taking time to realize that ideal. But that was the North Star that guided our progress as a society. And that was the key to our successes in becoming developed. So we ignore that history. We wipe it away when we think that it's a new problem. This problem has already been solved by the application of freedom for individuals.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
Well, if I was really ambitious, I would hope to actually change people's minds to be more hostile to autocrats in development, to be hostile to authoritarian violations of the rights of the poor. If I don't accomplish that, what I at least hope to accomplish is to just break the silence, to just say, yes, we can talk about it. We can talk about the human rights of the poor. We can talk about the democratic rights of the poor. We can talk about the oppression committed by dictators. That is okay. That does need to be part of the development discussion. Right now we have a silence. We have a repression. The World Bank president has never even used the word democracy in any of his speeches. I've verified that and confirmed it with the World Bank press office. You know, we have a complete absence of discussion on this subject right now, and we need to at least talk about it openly.
What kind of response are you getting to your book, especially from the aid agencies, for example?
Well, some positive ones. Some veterans say, yes, this is accurate. This is really going on. Maybe you're not even tough enough on what's going on. You should be even tougher. And of course, there's some very negative reactions. The U.S. writer Upton Sinclair once said, you'll never make a man understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it. I love that sentence. Can I say it again? You'll never get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it. So there is a way in which a lot of the existing experts, their job really depends on them not understanding the case for free development. Their job depends on them embracing authoritarian development. So, of course, there is going to be a lot of resistance from those people.
What is the best way forward to address global poverty, in your view?
Well, you know, I think people often want to move immediately to the five policy recommendations of what should be done differently in Washington and London. I don't think that's the right place to start, because first we have to convince the policymakers to care about the rights of the poor before they are going to start designing policies that, for example, force the World Bank to investigate when it violated some rights of poor people in Uganda with impunity. And so I think the first step is simply advocacy for rights of poor people, that we put it on the radar, that we make people care. There's been a lot of advocacy by Bono and Angelina Jolie about the material poverty of the poor, and that's great. I have nothing against it. I'm really glad they put that on everyone's radar and that they make people care more about the poor. I just wish we didn't neglect the other side of poor people's lives, that they also care about their own rights, their ability to make their own choices.
So what do you think is most standing in the way of people caring more about the rights of the poor in developing countries?
There's a little bit of a double standard, which is kind of understandable, that we care more about the rights of people who look like us, who act like us, who belong to similar cultures. And maybe we find it kind of hard to believe that people in other very different cultures really have these values of individual rights. I think that's one barrier. But in reality, these rights really are universal rights. These are not like Western values being imposed on the rest of the world. The Ethiopian dissident Eskinder Nega that I mentioned earlier, he had a letter from his jail cell. He said this in a beautiful way. He said, "We now have to see democracy no longer as the esoteric Western virtue, but as the universal aspiration of humanity."
What is the best approach for individuals who would like to help people in the poorer countries with an autocratic government?
Well, again, I think, you know, advocacy is the first step. And also, you know, advocacy is not just some vague general thing. It can very much concentrate on our own aid agencies, like the World Bank, which the U.S. funds a lot of, and the U.S. government aid agency, USAID, or even putting pressure on the Gates Foundation, which is sensitive to public opinion. You know, just say, hey, look, please don't praise autocrats, don't support autocrats, don't finance autocrats. Don't overlook rights violations by autocrats. Don't yourself violate the rights of poor people in your own projects done by USAID and World Bank. Now, these are very specific things that we can begin the conversation with on our own efforts to help poor people and to make them be better for poor people.
Do you see any hopeful trends in addressing global poverty?
Yeah, again, the long-run trend towards greater democracy is positive. The organization Freedom House has this classification of all the countries around the world into either free, not free, or partly free. And they've been doing that since 1972, and over that very long time period, the trend has been strongly upward. That's the really good news. You know, Latin America used to be filled with military rulers, now it's mostly democracies. Africa has less of the really bad autocrats like Mobutu and, you know, Emperor Bokassa of the Central African Republic and Idi Amin of Uganda. These kind of horrible cartoon figures that used to exist in Africa are much less frequent. And there are more new democracies in Africa like Ghana that has had five successive free and fair elections. So there is a hopeful trend towards greater democracy. And so we're not fighting a losing battle here. We're really from the side of a winning battle where poor people themselves are successfully getting their own democratic rights.
On the other side of things, do you see any negative trends?
Well, you know, I think the aid agencies and the philanthropic foundations are really resisting very hard these trends. It really does make their life more complicated. They want to keep their job simple, and it does make their life more complicated to say, look, it's not enough just to do the technical solutions. You really have to be sure that you're respecting the rights of poor people that you're dealing with and that you're not inadvertently, unintentionally helping the dictator oppress those poor people. You know, Ethiopia, to give another example, actually took famine relief that was given it by the aid agencies and used it as a political tool to starve the opposition and to give famine relief only to the ruling party supporters. So that's the kind of negative trend is when, you know, when the aid agencies allow that kind of behavior, then that's going to be a big barrier to making progress.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Free the poor. Respect the aspiration of poor people to be free. You know, just turn things around. Think about how you would feel if some saviors from the rest of the world told you that you had new rights and they cared only about your material poverty. Think about poor people, that they do want to have their own rights respected, and respect those rights. All men really are created equal.
Thanks so much for being here, Bill.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You are just listening to Bill Easterly, professor of economics at New York University, and author of the book, The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor, published in 2014 by Basic Books. For more information, check on the web at williameasterly.org. Again, that's William, EASTERLY.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the Streaming Archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and kexp.org.